immediate opening for a news writer producer? Visit democracynow.org/jobs to find out more and apply immediately. That does it for our show. Democracy Now! Is produced with Renee Feltz, Mike Burke, Dina Guzder, Messiah Rhodes, Nermeen Sheikh, Maria Tarasena, Tammy Warnoff, Camille Baker, Charina Nadura, Sam Alkoff, Tamari Astudio, John Hamilton, Ravi Karan, Hani Masood, Mary Conlin, and Juan Carlos Davila. Our executive director is Julie Crosby. Special thanks to Becca Staley, John Randolph, Paul Powell, Mike DeFilippo, Miguel Noguera, Hugh Grant, Dennis Moynihan, David Prude, and Dennis McCormick. I'm Amy Goodman. Stay safe.
ABU radio station is located in Portland, Oregon, in Multnomah County. We honor the indigenous people whose traditional and ancestral homelands we stand on. The Multnomah, Kathlamet, Clackamas, Tumwater, Watlala bands of the Chinook, the Tualatin, Kalapuya, and many other indigenous nations of the Willamette and Columbia River regions. It is important to acknowledge
this is the Roxanne ancestors Dunbar of this Ortiz, land and this is KBOO Portland.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available at our website at kboo.fm. Due to the temporary closure of in-station activity at KBOO, meetings will be conducted online via public video conferencing unless otherwise noted. A public link and phone number to attend the meetings are available on our website. The Development and Events Committee meets on the fourth Monday of the month at 4:30 p.m. Please visit our website at kboo.fm to verify if a meeting is being held.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, the Portland man accused in a mass shooting near Normandale Park makes his first court appearance, pleading not guilty. Judge Ketanji Brown Jackson's confirmation to the Supreme Court is likely after Senator Joe Manchin gives his approval. And in international news, President Joe Biden travels to Poland as rumors of mass deportations in Ukraine raise old fears. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Friday, March 25th, 2022. I'm Yasmin Kobanoglu. The Portland man accused of killing a woman and wounding four others at a demonstration near Normandale Park last month made his first appearance in court by video Thursday and pleaded not guilty. 43-year-old Benjamin Jeffrey Smith faces a 9-count indictment charging him with second-degree murder in the fatal shooting of 60-year-old June Brandy Knightley, a volunteer with a traffic crew for the protest and march. He also faces 4 counts of attempted first-degree murder, 3 counts of first-degree assault, and 1 count of second-degree assault. Smith had been hospitalized for more than a month after another man in the crowd is believed to have fired back, striking Smith in the hip. Smith underwent surgery at Oregon Health and Science University before being transferred and booked into the Multnomah County Detention Center on Wednesday. According to an arrest warrant affidavit, Smith lived in an apartment next to Normandale Park. On the night of the protest, Smith walked up to demonstrators at the park and demanded they leave. Protesters had gathered for a Justice for Patrick Kimmons rally, a regular event held at different locations in the city since shortly after Kimmons, a 27-year-old black man, was fatally shot by Portland police in 2018. Some in the crowd told Smith to go back home and leave them alone. Smith kept yelling and then drew a handgun and fired. According to court records, among those wounded, one person was shot in the neck and paralyzed. Another was shot multiple times, including in the abdomen, and 2 others were treated and released. One shot in the upper arm and another struck in multiple places. A trial date for Smith was tentatively set for May 5th, and the case has been assigned to Circuit Judge Michael A. Greenlick. Another Justice for Patrick Kimmons march and rally is planned from noon to 3 p.m. on Saturday, April 2nd, starting at Northeast Martin Luther King Jr. Boulevard and Killingsworth Street. A new report from the Sentencing Project finds almost 250,000 minors were incarcerated in the U.S. in 2019. Oregon is one of several states in the country that has no minimum age for prosecuting children. Eric Tegedoff has more on the story.
Children were incarcerated in massive numbers in 2019, according to new data. The Sentencing Project's report, Too Many Closed Doors, finds more than 240,000 minors were locked up that year, far greater than the annual point-in-time counts for any one day, which was about 36,000. Gabe Newland is Youth Justice Project Director for the Oregon Justice Resource Center. He says incarceration has a profound effect on children.
It takes them out of school, so it sets them behind in that way. And it's extremely traumatic. Kids in detention experience physical assault, different kinds of sexual violence. And even if they don't, they're being separated from their families. It's a profoundly harmful thing to do to a child.
The report finds children of color suffer the most from incarceration. The likelihood of a white youth being detained after arrest is about 20%, but for their Black and Latin heritage peers, the number is closer to 30%. Report author Josh Rovner with the Sentencing Project says kids should only be detained if they are a danger to themselves or others. Rovner also notes incarceration increases a young person's risk of suicide and dropping out, and causes great stress for families.
Overwhelmingly, these are kids who are charged with low-level offenses, and so we are making all of ourselves less safe because kids who are in these facilities are more likely to get arrested again, having been detained the first time.
Newland says in 2021, the American Bar Association urged states to change how young people are prosecuted.
The American Bar Association has called on all states to eliminate that practice for anyone under the age of 14. And Oregon is one of several states in the country that has no statute that establishes a minimum age.
The report also suggests redirecting public funds toward more effective solutions to locking kids up, as well as improving data collection. I'm Eric Tegedoff reporting.
President Joe Biden traveled to southeastern Poland on Friday to meet with U.S. troops and aid workers assisting refugees from Ukraine. The troops Biden visited are based less than 100 miles from where Russian missiles struck a Ukrainian military post this month. The service members have been carrying out training exercises with their Polish and British counterparts, familiarizing themselves with the local terrain and Polish equipment. The White House has firmly ruled out any possibility of sending U.S. troops to Ukraine, but has been bolstering its presence in Europe over the last 2 months to demonstrate Washington's commitment to defending NATO territory. A senior U.S. defense official said Friday that the Russian military has started to move reinforcements to Ukraine from Georgia. Russia invaded Georgia in 2008 and has kept troops in two secessionist areas in the country. This is the first time Russia has deployed additional troops to Ukraine after massing more than 150,000 forces on the border before invading the country a month ago. Officials say the move underscores how Russia's attack on Ukraine has failed to produce a swift victory and has been plagued by logistical and communication problems, despite Russia's overwhelming advantage in troop numbers and firepower. The Ukrainian Foreign Ministry said Thursday that 6,000 residents of the besieged city of Mariupol had been stripped of their passports and identity documents, forcibly deported by Russian forces, and taken to Russia as hostages. These claims have been impossible to verify. However, they echo allegations and details released by the Mariupol City Council, stating that several thousand of its residents had been taken to so-called filtration camps in Russia before being redirected to remote Russian cities. The trauma and memory of mass deportations inflicted by the then Soviet Union are still fresh. An estimated 3 million people on the USSR's borders were rounded up and forcibly deported to remote parts of Siberia and Central Asia between 1936 and 1952, many from Poland and Ukraine. According to the United Nations, as of Thursday, more than 1,008 civilians have been killed and another 1,700 injured in Ukraine following Russia's attack. A report from the Prosecutor General's Office of Ukraine said that as of 8 a.m. local time Friday, 135 children had been killed and 184 injured. The UN said it believes the actual figures are considerably higher, given information delays and many reports pending confirmation. Workers in the tulip fields of a farm in northwest Washington have gone on strike because of a wage dispute and wider concerns over working conditions. The strike comes just 1 week before the month-long Skagit Valley Tulip Festival begins. Eric Tegedoff has more on the story.
The tulips in Skagit County may be blooming, but the farm workers tending to them say there are serious issues with working conditions. About 70 workers and members of the union Familias Unidas por la Justicia have gone on strike after what's been described as a pay bonus mix-up between two groups of workers, who say it's also happened in the past. It comes 1 week before the popular Skagit Valley Tulip Festival begins on April 1st. Union organizer Marciano Sanchez spoke from the Northwest Washington farm where the strike is taking place about the Washington Bulb Company's response to the wage issue.
One of the only reasons that they noticed that there was an error on their part was because the workers decided to do a work stoppage and decided to go on strike. And there was news outlets that were here reporting on it. And that's the only reason why the company actually decided to check up into this.
The Washington Bulb Company says the bonus pay issue was an inadvertent error by its staff. The company says it resolved the issue and made the decision to compensate all groups at the higher bonus level. But Sanchez says workers have concerns beyond the pay confusion.
They wanted better working conditions, cleaner restrooms, and a better pay structure, or like a higher bonus that they get paid.
Workers also are looking for an improved sick leave policy and safe application of pesticides. The Skagit Valley Tulip Festival attracts thousands to the region during the month-long event. For Washington News Service, I'm Eric Tegedoff.
11 states in the U.S. have enacted laws that limit participation for transgender athletes. Supporters say it's about fairness in girls and women's sports, but opponents say the real outcry should be about longstanding disparities in supporting female athletes and their programs. Mike Moen has more on the story.
This weekend, the University of South Dakota women's basketball team continues its magical run in the NCAA tournament. It's happening under the umbrella of a new state law targeting trans athletes, a movement some describe as misguided in supporting women's programs. With the Coyotes advancing to the Sweet 16, there's been a regional buzz. Sarah Axelson of the Women's Sports Foundation says that should happen more often, rather than laws that ban transgender girls and women from playing on teams consistent with their gender identity. Axelson says that isn't a problem, especially when so many others exist.
We need legislators to start paying attention to overall participation opportunities, access, Title IX compliance, scholarships, facilities, uniforms, coaching, the fight for equal pay.
She says advancements could align with the 50th anniversary of Title IX this year. The law prohibits discrimination in education-sponsored activities receiving federal funding. South Dakota and Iowa recently joined the fray of states passing transgender sports bans. Supporters of those bans say their goal is fairness, arguing that trans girls hold competitive advantages over cisgender athletes. But the foundation echoes other opponents in countering that these laws are a solution in search of a problem. Meanwhile, at the pro level, Axelson says emerging leagues for women need more attention so they can grow.
The WNBA has just reached some really monumental investment deals, right? And they're 25 years in. And so some of these other women's leagues are newer, but they're still seeking that sponsorship and seeking the investment.
And as people tune into March Madness, Axelson hopes they're mindful of the gaps in resources women players are afforded compared to men's teams. She refers to a social media post from last year's tournament comparing workout facilities.
The men had what the picture showed was a state-of-the-art facility. The women had a tower of dumbbells where I think they didn't exceed like 30 pounds and a stack of yoga mats.
The backlash led to a review of NCAA championships in terms of gender equity. I'm Mike Moen reporting.
West Virginia Senator Joe Manchin, a Democrat, said on Friday that he intends to vote yes on Judge Ketanji Brown Jackson's nomination to the Supreme Court. This effectively guarantees she will be confirmed and become the first Black woman to serve on the nation's highest court. A simple majority of 51 of the 100 senators must vote yes for Jackson to be confirmed. The Senate is evenly split between 50 Democratic caucus members and 50 Republican members, with Vice President Kamala Harris casting a tie-breaking vote, giving Democrats a slight majority. So far, no Republicans have announced their support for Jackson, and some have already indicated they will vote no. Republican Senator Mitch McConnell of Kentucky said Thursday that he will not support Jackson's nomination. McConnell's opposition is not surprising. and likely foretells the stance of the vast majority of the GOP. However, some Republican moderates, notably Maine Senator Susan Collins or Alaska Senator Lisa Murkowski, could decide to support Jackson. They both voted yes on her appointment to her current role, as did South Carolina Senator Lindsey Graham, whose aggressive questioning and visible dissatisfaction with some of Jackson's answers in this week's confirmation hearings suggest he will not vote to support her again. While Republicans have attacked Jackson's record, Democrats have praised her credentials and experience, describing her as exceptionally qualified. Senate Democrats are hoping to move swiftly to a confirmation vote by the full Senate by early next month. You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for Counterspin, featuring a discussion with Carol Anderson, the Charles Howard Candler Professor of African American Studies at Emory University, about the historical and ongoing struggle between white supremacy and this country's hopes for democracy. Then at 6, it's the final installment of KBOO's Women's History Month series, featuring From Turban to Hijab, Voices of Women with Head Coverings, followed by What is Transfeminism? Tonight's weather will be partly cloudy with a low of 47 degrees. Tomorrow will be cloudy with a high of 65 degrees. Today in history, in 1911, the Triangle Shirtwaist Company factory in New York City burns down, killing 146 workers. One of the darkest moments of America's industrial history, the tragedy led to the development of a series of laws and regulations that better protected the safety of factory workers. The quote of the day is from American lawyer and politician Robert F. Kennedy, who served as the 64th U.S. Attorney General until his assassination. Kennedy said, quote, "Each time a man stands up for an ideal, or acts to improve the lot of others, or strikes out against injustice, he sends forth a tiny ripple of hope. And crossing each other from a million different centers of energy and daring, those ripples build a current that can sweep down the mightiest walls of oppression and resistance." President Joe Biden says the U.S. is prepared to accept Ukrainian refugees. The Supreme Court rejects a GOP redistricting plan in Wisconsin. And Donald Trump sues Hillary Clinton over the 2016 presidential campaign. With more on the story, it's Jonah Chester with 2022 Talks.
Welcome to 2022 Talks, where we are following our democracy in historic times.
Today, I'm announcing the United States is prepared to commit more than $1 billion in humanitarian assistance to help get relief to millions of Ukrainians affected by the war in Ukraine.
President Joe Biden was in Europe Thursday for a meeting of NATO allies to discuss the ongoing Ukraine crisis. In addition to new financial aid for Ukraine and economic sanctions against Russia, the president announced America is prepared to accept 100,000 Ukrainian refugees. The United Nations reports more than 3.6 million refugees have fled Ukraine since late February, with the majority entering neighboring countries like Poland, Hungary, Slovakia, Romania, and Moldova. During a news conference in Brussels, President Biden also told reporters NATO allies would be forced to respond should Russia deploy chemical weapons during its invasion of Ukraine.
The nature of the response would depend on the nature of the use.
Supreme Court confirmation hearings for Ketanji Brown Jackson enter day four Thursday. Ann Claire Williams of the American Bar Association told lawmakers the organization's Federal Judiciary Committee voted unanimously Judge Jackson was well qualified to serve on the nation's high court.
To get that well-qualified rating, a Supreme Court nominee must be a preeminent member of the legal profession, have outstanding legal ability, have exceptional breadth of experience, and meet the very highest standards of integrity, professional competence, and judicial temperament.
Williams said everyone the committee talked to, including more than 2,800 judges and lawyers, uniformly praised Judge Jackson. Meanwhile, the High Court shot down a redistricting plan in Wisconsin appealed by the state's legislative Republicans after the Wisconsin Supreme Court ruled in favor of voting maps submitted by Democratic Governor Tony Evers. Wednesday's decision means the state will need to draft new legislative maps, but the court ruled Wisconsin can go ahead for now with congressional maps submitted by Evers. A Senate committee Wednesday considered testimony about racial discrimination in the home appraisal process. The hearing comes after Housing and Urban Development Secretary Marcia Fudge this week introduced a new plan to tackle discriminatory appraisal practices. Melody Taylor with the department says racist housing practices can adversely impact the transfer of generational wealth and further entrench racial disparities.
This is the American dream. Sadly, accounts of appraisal bias have captured national headlines in recent months.
In her testimony, Taylor cited a 2021 study by Freddie Mac, which found appraisals for home purchases in majority Black and Latino neighborhoods were valued lower than similar homes in predominantly white neighborhoods. And Donald Trump is suing Hillary Clinton, alleging she attempted to topple his presidency through a coordinated misinformation campaign. Politico reports the former president has alleged Clinton, alongside dozens of her allies, attempted to destabilize Trump's administration by saying he colluded with Russia to swing the 2016 election. I'm Jonah Chester for Pacifica Network and Public News Service. Find our 8 trust indicators to support transparency and accuracy at publicnewsservice.org.
The City of Toronto has unveiled its first ever plan to support reconciliation with Indigenous people. The Blackfeet Nation in Montana has declared a state of emergency to address a series of opioid overdoses and deaths. And Supreme Court nominee Judge Ketanji Brown Jackson was asked about her knowledge of tribes during confirmation hearings this week. With those stories and more, it's Antonia Gonzalez with National Native News.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. The City of Toronto has unveiled its first ever plan to support reconciliation with Indigenous people. Dan Karpinchuk reports.
Toronto has one of Canada's largest urban Indigenous populations, and along with that has come higher rates of homelessness and poverty. The Reconciliation Action Plan was developed over 3 years with input from Indigenous, Inuit, and Métis people, along with elders, knowledge keepers, youth, and Indigenous employers and city allies. The plan has 28 goals included in 5 themes. They are actions to restore truth, to correct relations, and share power, for justice, financial reparations, and actions for the Indigenous Affairs Office. Toronto Mayor John Tory says the city has a role to play in advancing truth and reconciliation with Indigenous people.
The message was conveyed loud and clear to me that this just cannot be another government report. And I want to reiterate that the Reconciliation Action Plan is a living document that will grow, and it will evolve, and it must grow, and it must evolve as needed to ensure that it is in fact credible and effective as seen through the eyes of Indigenous communities, and is a work plan for the government that comes from our Indigenous communities.
The plan also includes the creation of 5,200 affordable rental homes and the creation of an Indigenous crisis response pilot. The city also plans to apologize to Métis, improve relationships with treaty and territorial partners, and boost Indigenous economic development. The action plan will be considered by the Executive Committee next week and then go before Toronto City Council a week later. For National Native News, I'm Dan Karpinchuk.
The Blackfeet Nation in Montana has declared a state of emergency to address a series of opioid overdoses and deaths. Montana Public Radio's Aaron Bolton has more.
The Blackfeet Tribal Business Council's declaration states there were 17 opioid overdoses and 4 deaths on the Blackfeet Indian Reservation in just a week's time. The Blackfeet tribe is forming a task force led by tribal law enforcement and behavioral health officials to craft recommendations on how to deal with the growing issue and will report back to the tribal council. Recently, Montana law enforcement has found fentanyl in counterfeit prescription pills. Methamphetamine is also increasingly laced with the powerful drug. State law enforcement officials say the number of deaths related to fentanyl overdoses nearly tripled across Montana from 2016 to 2020. All deaths related to opioid overdoses have increased at similar rates, according to a state health department analysis of the most recent data. That report shows Indigenous Montanans are dying from drug overdoses at nearly 3 times the rate of white Montanans. For National Native News, I'm Aaron Bolton.
U.S. Supreme Court nominee Judge Ketanji Brown Jackson was asked about her knowledge of tribes during confirmation hearings this week before the Senate Judiciary Committee. California Senator Alex Padilla questioned her about tribal sovereignty and the unique relationship tribes have with the federal government, saying she's had limited experience with Native rights cases. But if confirmed, there will eventually be cases involving tribes. Padilla asked the federal judge to explain her understanding of U.S. tribal relations.
Indian tribes are as a general matter, considered to be sovereigns. And the relationship is a sovereign-to-sovereign relationship, but it's one in which the federal government has some responsibilities related to the Indian Nation.
Tribal leaders and directors of Native organizations are stressing the need for the next Supreme Court justice to understand, recognize, and uphold principles of tribal sovereignty, treaty rights, and federal trust responsibilities. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
A project manager for a solar company successfully pushed for a simpler permitting process in Philadelphia. It's one simple way cities can make it easier for people to go solar. Dr. Anthony Leisowitz has more on the story with Climate Connections.
I'm Dr. Anthony Leisowitz, and this is Climate Connections. Philadelphia native Mark Shackelford Rowell says the solar industry creates jobs, helps the climate, and reduces people's energy costs. So he wants to make it easier for solar projects to move forward in Philly. Shackelford Rowell works as a project manager for Solar States, a Philly-based company. He says when he started there, it often took more than a month and a lot of paperwork for the city to issue a permit for a new installation, and projects were often held up in review.
Some developers would be hesitant to add solar to their new construction projects.
The problem is not unique to Philly. Experts say that permitting and other so-called soft costs can add substantially to the price tag of a project, so it can be a barrier for rapid solar adoption.
I saw how turning around permits and getting projects through the approval phase was having a strain on the industry.
So Shackelford Rowell worked with other companies and city agencies to develop an expedited permitting process for residential solar. Now, contractors can fill out a simple online form and get a standard project approved within 3 days. Shackelford Rowell says the streamlined process makes the city of brotherly love a more welcome place for solar. Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. To hear more stories like this, visit climateconnections.org.
Students in the U.S. went on strike today, joining the global Fridays for Future movement, inspired by climate activist Greta Thunberg. In Colorado, students gathered on the steps of the state capitol building, then marched to a Chase Bank branch, calling on the company to divest its fossil fuel holdings. Eric Galatis has more on the story.
Colorado students are expected to gather at the state capitol today, joining a global climate youth strike. Students will also march to a Chase Bank location to urge the company to divest fossil fuel holdings they say are aiding Russia's war in Ukraine. Madeline Pierce, a high school sophomore, says young people understand that it's going to take more than recycling and biking to school to avert the most catastrophic impacts of a warming planet.
I think it's always beneficial to take little steps, but the majority of emissions are from larger companies. The most beneficial thing to do is to call out these corporations for their climate change emissions, because that's the most impact that we can make if we use our voice.
Pierce points to research showing that 100 oil and gas companies are responsible for more than 70% of the world's greenhouse gas emissions. More than half of emissions are linked to just 25 corporate and state-owned entities. J.P. Morgan Chase has not yet responded to a request for comment. Chase is the largest investor in the Russian-owned natural gas company Gazprom, according to a recent Politico report, and activists say divestment will help international sanctions on Russia stick. Between 2016 and 2020, Chase reportedly gave Gazprom $3.5 billion in financing. Pierce says Chase is in a position to reduce both climate pollution and violence in Ukraine.
Gazprom has become a central way for Russia to work around these sanctions and provide funding for the invasion. We're asking JP Morgan to not only divest from Gazprom because of their involvement with the war in Ukraine, but because of their involvement with natural gas emissions.
The global Fridays for Future movement, inspired by Greta Thunberg, has seen over 140 million people mobilized to keep average global temperatures from rising above levels deemed dangerous by scientists. Pierce believes the movement may be reaching a tipping point.
There was polling released last month that shows 82% of Coloradans consider climate change a serious problem, and 98% say wildfires that threaten homes and property are a serious problem.
This is Eric Galatis reporting.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News for Friday, March 25th, 2022. Call or text us with your breaking news stories and tips at 971-245-2158. The producer for tonight's newscast is Yasmin Kobanoglu, and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Jonah Chester, Eric Galatis, Antonia Gonzalez, Mike Moen, Eric Tegadoff, and Dr. Anthony Lizowitz. The director of Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kbu.fm/eveningnews. You're listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Yasmin Kobanoglu. All of these KBOO programs, including the Evening News, are made possible by support from our members. If you'd like to become a member and support our programming, you can go to kbu.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. Stay tuned now for Counterspin.
Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines. I'm Janine Jackson. This week on Counterspin, I heard a cable TV commentator say recently that with the invasion of Ukraine, Russia's Vladimir Putin is trying to, quote, put an end to democracy as we know it, close quote. I know I wasn't the only one wondering, among other things, what we was being invoked there, and what's the definition of the democracy we're meant to be endorsing? Does it account for the people who broke into the U.S. Capitol last January, trying to violently overturn a presidential election? What about their supporters, explicit and implicit? The thing is, corporate news media don't define the democracy they invoke as shorthand justification for pretty much anything, including war. It's a murky stand-in for a good society where people have a voice and stuff, even when and where